Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Welcome to the Bucher and Friends podcast. Here is your host.
Let's send it over to Rick Bucher.
Rick Bucher.
Welcome to a very special episode of Bucher and Friends, part of the United WeCast Network. I'm Rick Bucher. You can see me on FS1. You can hear me on Fox Sports Radio. You will be able to read me someplace soon. We're going to have an announcement on that. And you can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Rick Bucher. And it is my great pleasure to invite into the show today a Hall of Famer. I say that and I wait for that smile to come up on his face because I know what that must mean to him. Spencer Haywood, NBA Hall of Famer, champion, and quite a fascinating story, which you can find in the new book, The Spencer Haywood Rule, Battles Basketball and the Making of an American Iconoclast. Written not by one, but two writers, which I have to tell you, Spencer, first of all, welcome. It's great to see you. It's good to see you in good health. How are you at this moment?
I'm doing great. This is just... the NBA community has been open... with open arms. Adam Silver has been really open. Chris Paul from the PA, from the Players Union, Michelle Roberts. And all of you guys from, you know, the broadcast industry and television industry, it's just been so awesome to open up this book and take a look at it and read through some of the journeys that I've been through and how I changed the game of basketball, thus the name of the Spencer Haywood Rule, because we have all of these names for my ruling: early entry, hardship, one and done. It's just one name. It's the Spencer Haywood Rule. And one of the great guys who helped get this book deal was former Commissioner David Stern, who was going to write the foreword. And, you know, he moved on before that into the heavens. But, gosh, and I got Mark Spears from ESPN, undefeated, and Gary Washburn from the Boston Globe. You know, I play with the Knicks, so that's kind of hard to say Boston. And I got on my Laker shirt here, so Boston.
Yeah. So, for those who may not know, 1970... a case involving Spencer went all the way to the Supreme Court, and it was essentially Spencer fought for the right to play in the NBA before his let me make sure I have this right, before the 4 years of college eligibility were up. That was the rule at the time, correct? And it sounds weird to say that now. If you spend 4 years in college now, you're probably not getting drafted more often than not, right? So again, I get all choked up just imagining what that was like. But 1970, you took the case and you basically fought for the right to go from the ABA signed by the Seattle Supersonics, and then the league tried to keep you out. And you and Sam Schulman, the owner of the Sonics, took the case and ultimately fought for that. Now, Most people don't know that history. They know the Larry Bird rule. They know a variety of rules that are named after players.
Yeah.
How are you now with the fact that the Kobes and the LeBrons and just about every possible star you can think of?
Michael Jordan, Magic
Michael Jordan, Johnson. Michael Jordan leaving early. I mean, all of them. Charles left early. Everybody leaves early, right?
Yeah.
Yes, go down the line.
Yeah.
They were all able to do that because of the battle that you took on. And in reading the book, there was a certain amount of resentment on your part that for the longest time, your battle and your fight was not acknowledged. In fact, you were castigated for having fought that. So I wonder where your mindset is now about what you went through and the door that opened that many people to this day have not recognized.
Well, you know, it took, I say that it took 50 years, and that's why we are here with the book today. Because, you know, if you notice in my Hall of Fame speech, I made reference that, you know, I waited 27 years to get into the hall.
Mm.
And I said at the closing statement was that everything is happening to me and for me is not on my time, but it's on God's time.
Mm.
And so I have just embraced the idea that this is the right time. I mean, how do you just say all of this is happening right now when Black Lives Matters, you got the floor and the players are now being so conscious.
Yep.
And they are starting to read and they're starting to hear about this guy, Spencer Haywood. It's just so awesome. And again, it's right on time.
Hmm.
It's right on time. So I don't have the anger or the resentment that I used to have because I thought, well, you know, I've helped players make billions of dollars. And not only that, but for their families, for their communities. You know, I hate using LeBron as an example, but he's the king, so I have to use him as an example. You know, for a guy like him, he left 4 years early.
Yep.
So he makes $50 million a year. So you're looking at a couple of million dollars. I mean, what, $200 million over that period? And you have 4 years to tack on to your stats, to tack on to your life of your legs. I mean, it's just an incredible thing. So, you know, I just look at what I've done with players and with the ownership, because the ownership at my time when I fought this case, each club was basically averaging about $250 million to $350 million, and now they're rounding out basically at $3 billion or $2 billion, so they had a chance to expand. Also, the league had a chance to expand because before I came along, you didn't have a chance to expand because players was waiting 4 years in college.
Hmm.
So you couldn't get players coming in early. You just couldn't get them. So that therefore you had a stagnant group of players coming in, and you know, so all of a sudden this thing opened up. And when it opened up, all of a sudden you got revenue, you got, you know, everything just happened around that one person. And you know, they always used to say in the cotton fields of Silver City, ain't nothing good coming out of Silver City, Mississippi. And lo and behold, here I am, this kid who was born into indentured slavery. 3 years later, I am chosen to save America in the 68 Olympics. I did that. The next step, I was chosen to save the ABA from folding. I did that because I averaged 30 points and 20 rebounds for that season, rookie of the year, leading scorer, leading rebounder. And then here I am thrust into the Supreme Court right up front. Now, I know Don King and everybody waved the flag and it only could happen in America. Really? it only could happen in America.
That's a good point. So I do want to get to where we are with the Spencer Haywood rule, or it being named the Spencer Haywood rule, before we're done. But you mentioned growing up in Silver City, Mississippi.
Yes.
When was the last time, and what the atmosphere was like then, and maybe even to a certain extent now, I don't really know how much things have changed. When was the last time that you were back in Mississippi?
I was back in Silver City 2 years ago.
Okay.
My nephew is playing at Louisiana, University of Louisiana. He's the defensive player of the week, and yes, down there in the Southern Conference. And I went down to see him, and then my sister, she still lives in Mississippi, but not in Silver City. She lives in Jackson.
Okay.
So I was there hanging out and just walking through the cotton fields and saying, wow, have I been so blessed to get out of here. Because, you know, when I grew up, Rick, the one thing that I wanted to be was not a basketball player. I wanted to be the best cotton picker this county and this state had ever witnessed. So I was a kid. I was like 9 and 10 years old. I was practicing. And little did I know, practicing picking cotton and practicing, but I was working. It was working 12 hours a day. But picking, you know, because the cotton bowl is a thorn. You got to reach in and grab the cotton out and put it into a sack. And then you got to drag the sack to the next spot. And then you got to, sometime when the sack gets full, you got to lift it up and put it on your shoulder, bring it back to the trailer and dump it. So my legs developed as a kid. My shoulders developed. And my hand and eye coordination, because I didn't want to get stuck by the thorn. And so all of these development was going on. And then I got good coordination because I was picking from both rows. And so then when I picked up a basketball, and I always played basketball, but it was like, oh, okay, this is pretty easy stuff here, you know?
So you were big for a kid. And yeah. You obviously had a pretty good wingspan. How much did that allow you to be the cotton picker that you were, to like pick from two rows at the same time?
I was great at it. I was great at it. But also, because of my competitive spirit, I wanted to beat my brothers. I was like really into this thing. And most people are like, that's crazy. How could you be so brainwashed to be into this? And I was, because that to me was my first sport, that and golf, because I caddied over at the golf course. So that was my first, you know, sports that I got acquainted with, which was picking cotton. And so when I got to a gym where they said, well, you know, we're going to practice for 2 hours, I was like, oh my God, 2 hours? And I was used to working in the field for 12 hours and doing real work.
Yeah.
And so they put me in a gym and like, you know, practice for 2 hours.
I'm not even going to ask you about load management then. I'm not going to ask you about...
I did have load management.
But I do want to ask you, because it is such a prevalent thing in the book, and obviously from your experience, not just growing up, but subsequently, your trust of white people. Like, what... How do you feel about white people now? Like how is your perspective, if it's evolved, how has it evolved?
It didn't evolve in the sense that I didn't have mistrust in white people, because, you know, when we didn't have food in Silver City, there was a lot of time we didn't have food or whatever. And our white neighbors who were living, you know, like a mile away would come down and say, Eunice, that's my mother's name. I know you might need some of this food, you know, that I have, and we want to share it with you. So they shared it with our family, but my mother would like, now wait a minute, I'm going to take this food, but when my potato patch is ready, you know, the potato patch is when you plant potatoes.
Yeah.
I'm going to make you a sweet potato pie that's going to be out of this world. So, you know, I never experienced it like that hate thing, because we were like serious Christian family. We believed that, you know, the Lord would deliver us, and that we had a lot of love in that house, you know. Mm-hmm. It was like 9 children in there, and we just loved each other. And, you know, we didn't look at things from a racial standpoint. We looked at someone who had the advantage over us, but they wasn't like, you know, like, it was the Klan and everything else, but it wasn't like bad because we didn't view it as such. So
right.
I never had that problem. So I look at like what happened with Sam Schulman, which is a white man, but he's a Jewish man. He came to me and said, Spencer, we're going to the Supreme Court. It's going to cost me an arm and a leg. In fact, it cost him $1.7 million in that period in 1970 and 71 to go there.
Wow.
So how can I look at one side and say, oh man, this is a great guy and this is great stuff, but yet I hold that resentment back and I don't.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I had to go through a lot of stuff to get to this place that I am now, and it's a good place. It's
yeah.
a real place, yeah.
So you, in the book, it talks about how leaving Seattle, like there was a lot of times where you felt betrayed throughout, right?
Yeah.
But leaving Seattle, at least the way the book presents it, was really tough on you. That was, when you were traded to New York, there was something that you really felt betrayed. Why did that, of all the things that happened, because we could go to Detroit, we could go,
yeah.
like we could go to a lot of places where you felt like you were abandoned or
yeah.
that you were sold a bill of goods. Why did Seattle cut so deep?
Seattle cut real deep because my family, my brothers and my sisters, not my mother, she stayed down in Mississippi, but they had moved to Seattle. I had a family around me. I had love and care. And when I was going through the Supreme Court case, the people of Seattle, white and black, but mostly white, they covered me like with this love, you know, like I didn't fear anything. And when I played basketball, I played it with like life and death. When I would go home at night after the game, I would just be exhausted totally. I couldn't move. And so I had put so much into Seattle. And also during that court case, you know, I cried a lot. I hurt a lot. And the restaurants, when I would go into them, they would just grab me and hug me and just love me up. Hmm. So I was like a child being put out of your own home.
Hmm.
So that's where the pain came
yeah.
from. And it's still painful to come sometime to talk about it because that's where I was.
Yeah.
And when I got to New York, I mean, my game suffered, but I did fall in love with Iman, the model.
Right.
And we started our family and I had a great experience there. But Seattle was like, that was a painful journey, you know?
Understandable.
I didn't know anybody. I didn't, you know.
Yeah.
And these guys were older players, and so they didn't, you know. What are you doing coming here going to save the Knicks? Who are you? You know.
So the championship Knicks are coming off of championships
right.
and getting older, which put you in a tough spot there.
And then I was replacing Willis Reed, Dave DeBuscher, and Jerry Lucas. So I couldn't replace three guys.
Yeah, yeah. It's a big, big task, a big ask.
Yes.
For those who may not know, so you grew up in Mississippi. Your family, you moved to Detroit and
right.
lived with a family there, in part because your older brother had gone there to play basketball, correct?
Yes.
Or had moved there for high school.
Yeah,
right.
and he played high school basketball, and he was playing at Bowling Green State University.
Right, right.
And so he wanted me to come up to Detroit to get to be with this great coach, Will Robinson, and we finally got with him as a coach. And in fact, he was the first black coach to coach in NCAA Division I, and he coached the great Doug Collins in college. Illinois State.
Ah, yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
All of us are connected.
Yeah. Yeah. No, no, no. And for anybody, please read the book because your connection to a variety. Bill Russell in Seattle as the coach. I mean, all along the way. What's that?
John Lennon, who was tutored and coached and brought to life by Naismith,
right.
Kansas,
right,
who coached me in the Olympics and also was my first coach in Denver with the Denver Rockets.
Right, right, right.
Yeah, all these things are like, you know,
yeah,
and Hank Iber, who was the coach of the Olympic team.
Right, right, right. Legendary coach. No. I honestly, when I was reading it, I felt like Spencer Haywood's kind of like Forrest Gump. Like he's connected to all of these like momentous people and events. The thing that got me that when you were in Detroit, and this is after high school when you played at Detroit Mercy. And by the way, I think my daughter is talking to them about trying to play basketball there. So. I've been looking at that school. There was a lounge that you would go to where you heard George Benson, Miles Davis, Wes Montgomery, Pharaoh Sanders, and I was like, it blew my mind. So tell me, what was it like to see Miles Davis perform in a lounge?
Yeah, but it's the oldest jazz club in the world.
Okay.
It's called Baker's Keyboard Lounge on 7 Mile in Livernois. And to this day, everyone still come through Baker's.
Okay.
And Miles was in Detroit at that time because he was trying to shake off some heroin addiction, I think it was. And so we used to go up because, you know, the school, it's like a mile away. So we would walk up that mile and they were like, you know, you're underage, but we're going to let you come in because you know you love these guys, because I was a jazz cat. I've always been a jazz man. And to see him perform and just, I mean, his tone was a little shaky, but he was there and he was playing. And then later on, I saw Wes Montgomery. And I'm waiting, you know, he's just playing the guitar. And so he had his cigarette in the string. So we're like watching, and you're like, hey, man, is that ash going to fall? You know, and he finally hit the last note, vroom. And the ash fell, and we were like, oh, Wes! You know, you got to be a jazz man.
Yeah. No, that's good stuff.
That whole journey.
Are there any of the guys, like, those are the guys that are mentioned in the book. Is there anybody else? Like, if you think about one of the most memorable performances or opportunities to hear or see somebody play that was just so unique because of that circumstance. Because you were in Detroit at a time where obviously the jazz was there, but Motown was kicking off. Like, that was the place. I mean, there was a lot going on in Detroit at that time.
So, you know, Melvin Franklin of the Temptations, the Great Temptations, would come to all of our games. Smokey and all of the people would come to all of the U of D games, the University of Detroit Mercy games. And they would say, hey, you want to come by and listen to us at Motown and rehearse? And I'm like, oh, yes,
yeah.
I want to. Please. So you go into the studio, you think like, wow, it's going to be this big place, you know? And it was right there on Grand Boulevard. You go in there and you see Diana Ross walking through and you're like, what the? And man, they would like start playing and they would do their rehearsal. And we just sitting there, me and my buddy Wiley Davis and Vernell DeSilva, we just sitting there like, oh man, we done died and went to heaven. And just listening to them getting ready for songs, you know, I mean, it was just incredible. And then they had like a 20 or 25 piece orchestra packed in the basement.
Seriously, because that's not a big place, right? I mean, that's like a little storefront type of place.
And you had all of the Detroit Symphony Orchestra, you know, all of the string sections, and they're like, I was like, oh my God, because I came from Silver City, Mississippi.
Sure.
Remember,
sure.
There is no silver and it ain't no city. So I'm going from these old backwood boys playing with three string guitars and stuff like that. So you're playing like this thrumming, do-do-do-do-do. They just playing that sound.
Yeah.
And then the bus would come through because we lived on the highway 49W.
Okay.
49W was the blues route. So, you know.
Oh, through Silver City?
Yeah.
And okay.
Cafe, we had one cafe in the town. And so all of the blues players would stop at this cafe and eat. Mm. And we would like go up and meet B.B. King and all of those great Howlin' Wolf and all those people. I was like, oh, man. And then I get to Detroit. And I'm thinking, you know, doom, 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 doom. They get there, ooh, baby, I'm losing you. And, you know, like, they got a whole nother level. And I'm like, oh, man, what? This is so beautiful. And then I'm in the studio with those people. It was just incredible.
Yeah.
Incredible.
Yeah.
And I see Smokey sometime on the golf course, and we see each other in a number of events, you know. And we just sit back and laugh, like, wow, you were this greenhorn kid from Mississippi sitting in our studio. We should have kicked you out.
So what's it like to see, and you've been a proponent of bringing or revitalizing Detroit in a number of ways since you retired. What's it like to have seen it then at a heyday, see where it went, and see where it is now?
Yeah. In this heyday, when I got there, everybody had two-car garages or one-car garage. You worked at Ford, General Motors, or Chrysler. And to come from making $2 a day from Mississippi, there was a train of people who came up, and people from Europe who were coming in from Europe and so on. But to see people who were like just living a beautiful life, because we had Hamtramck right down the street, and that was all of the Polish people, Rudy Tomjanovich and all those guys that we used to play with. And that was sitting right in Detroit. You know, Hamtramck is not outside of Detroit.
Right.
Detroit. And so you had all of these people, and we just had all this culture going on, you know. And, you know, you could just feel, and people were living really well because you were making $18 and $20 an hour back then. And you had a union that protected you, had, you know, health care and all the other stuff. So to see all of that, and then in 67, we burned the place down because of police injustice.
Right.
And it started with the riot on 12th Street. And then all of a sudden, I came back there. The reason I was recruited back to the University of Detroit after my Olympic gold medal stint in the 68 Olympics through Governor Romney, not this Governor Romney, but his dad, and Mayor Kavanaugh, we wanted to rebuild it. The city of Detroit. And at that time, the Tigers were jumping. The Detroit Tigers they had won the world champion. And so we were there. And then to go away for all of those years playing professional basketball. And then when Iman and I divorced, I came back home and I looked at my city and I was like, oh my God, what happened? Mm-hmm. And so I went and met with Mayor Coleman Young at the time. And I said, well, I want to take some of my retirement funds and my retirement money because I got everything from Detroit. So I want to put something back. And he's like, you're taking your retirement? Are you crazy? And I invested my money into Detroit. And the project is still there. Circle Drive is a $19 million project. I didn't put up no $19 million now, but I have a nice piece.
Yeah.
I saw that growth. And then the owner of the Cleveland Cavaliers, my mind slipped.
Dan Gilbert
came into town with Quicken Loans.
Yep.
And they just bought up all of the downtown area. They are developing all of that. It's like a new day. It's like you come to Detroit now. It's like, whoa.
Yeah.
I mean, downtown, they've taken up the streets and and just got cafes all up and down Woodward, just like I was when I was a kid.
Yeah.
So all of that stuff, and see that revitalization. The Pistons moved from the Palace. They built themselves a stadium downtown. The Lions are no longer over on Michigan Avenue. They are downtown.
Right.
You see those beautiful stadiums and see the restaurant industry. The waterfront is being developed. I mean, Detroit is a place you want to
It's
really
starting
be.
To come back, for sure. I was there last, not this past season, but the season before. And I did a piece on, met with Blake Griffin there. And I've known Derrick Rose for a while. And so I caught up with them. And yeah, I was pleasantly surprised that you didn't have to hike it out to the suburbs in order to go to a game, or like the downtown certainly is coming back.
Yes. I'm proud of that city. It's just, and Dan Gilbert, man, that guy, I know he's in Cleveland.
Yep.
With the team, but he and.
But he's a Detroit guy. He's a Michigan guy. If he could own the Pistons, he would trade that. He would trade franchises in a heartbeat, sure. Yeah.
So all of those guys are in there. Magic is Magic Johnson is putting some of the money back into it.
Yeah.
These are former players that are doing it. Jalen Rose have the Jalen Rose Academy there.
Yep.
I mean, you know, you got Vinny Johnson, who's a billionaire now because he's in the auto industry, and I mean, you got Bill Laimbeer, who had his father had Piston Packaging, which is a packaging company for the auto industry. So we have a lot of players who did really well in Detroit. So.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Who among the players, because when you first came in, you weren't embraced as a trailblazer and a guy who created opportunity. You were looked at as a guy who had created competition for the guys who were in the league, and they resented you for that. Are there guys that you were crossways or sideways with then? Who are the guys that you've either like bridged the gap, have a different relationship with now? And is there anybody out there that you still haven't, you know, you're still at odds and you wish you weren't, but you are?
I don't have any odds now, because when I did my recovery stint 30 years ago, I started making amends and talking to people. And as part of my psychologist was saying, you know, you gotta go in, you gotta talk to people, you gotta like make these, you gotta feel what, and let it all out of your stomach and all out of it. That's why I went back to Mississippi, played golf and hung out with the old farmers and stuff like that. So it was all part of my
Getting
stuff together. And now, let me just tell you a little bit about what the union was about at that time, because the union was told by the owners that, you know, if this guy win this case, you old heads, all of the old basketball players or the players who had been in the league, you're going to become obsolete. They're going to push you right out. These young LeBron James type players are going to come, the Bob McAdoos, Spencer Haywood, Adrian Dantley, all these people are going to come and they're going to push you out and you're going to be gone. So they had to fight, and Kareem, he did a great thing for me when we played Milwaukee after the case. He came out and wouldn't stay downstairs, because players would stay downstairs and leave me up on the floor.
What do you mean?
During the case, when the case was going on, they would have an injunction for me waiting. So I mean, when they would have a 10-day injunction, I got an injunction against the NBA to play, so I played for 10 days, and they were like, ladies and gentlemen, we got these illegal player on the floor, and these next 10 games are playing under protest.
They would announce this.
Yes.
In the arena. To the fans.
In the arena with the fans. And so then we would go on, and then I would get an injunction to play again, and they were like, they will serve me with another injunction and say, we was in Cincinnati. We playing against the great Big O and everybody, Jerry Lucas, I think it was. And
Cincinnati, I mean, Gardens.
Huh?
Cincinnati Gardens.
Cincinnati Garden. It was, Jack Twyman, yep. John Tresvant, Wayne Embry, all of those guys.
Yep.
And I'm thinking, you know, we're going to like ball tonight, man. I'm playing against my hero, Oscar Robertson, the Big O. And they said, ladies and gentlemen, we have an illegal player on the floor, number 24. And we have an injunction right here. He must be escorted out of this arena and off the grounds in which this arena sat on. So they put me out into the snow. And I'm sitting out there in the snow. I'm freezing like, oh, man, I'm going to die.
Not to the locker room. They didn't let you go to the locker room. They put you out of the building.
Out of the building because it was a battle. And so sometime when I look at, you know what, sometime I look at what's going on today and I say, man, the security and police, they came out near me and they said, we are breaking the law. Get in the car and warm up. You're not going to die out here.
Huh. Wow.
So then I warmed up and got back on the bus and go home. But it went on just like that. So it was just, it was an incredible time.
Would you, looking back now, everything that you went through and how long, and even now to say that you haven't really been recognized for what you went through.
Yeah.
If you had it to do all over again, would you still want to be that guy that fought the fight?
Yeah. Because, really? You know, I got a chance to go to the Supreme Court for a battle, and I knew that all of these people were coming. They wanted to come into the league, but they couldn't come yet. Roger Brown, Connie Hawkins, all of these great players, a guy from Detroit named Curtis Jones, who was not an academic genius, but he was a savant on the floor. I mean, he went away to college, couldn't make it in college because they, you know, like he went to a party and they dropped some LSD on him, just screwed him up tremendously bad. So that's all of those players and all of these players that have came into the league. I have ushered in into the African American community about $22 billion worth of income that they would not have seen. And they before their brothers, sister, like Chris Paul, for an example, is under the rule. He has his brother, his family, their foundation, and all of these people, Maverick Carter, along with LeBron's people, Rich Paul. Rich Paul, all of these players, and they bring in their posse and their families. And then you go to Europe. You know, Dirk was one of the first, Yao Ming, all of those guys. I mean, they have brought so much comfort and wealth to their country. So for me, I'm just thinking, man, nothing good ever come out of the Silver City.
Well, you changed that. You changed that.
City. I changed it. And so I'm just I'm grateful. You know, I used to eat roadkill when I was a kid.
Right.
And now I'm sitting around eating vegan. So I'm looking at, you know, like it's this time in history for it to be told, the story to be told. Yeah. And I think if it had been told earlier, Rick, I don't know if it would have the significance that it's having now.
Yeah.
Because, you know, like I was watching Richard Jefferson talk about the book that he had just read on the jump the other day. And he was like, I didn't know anything. And he came in under my ruling.
Right.
And he's a, you know, he's sharp. So
yep. Yep.
It's like, wow. And Shaq and Charles doing a lot of good stuff for me, you know, like they just talking me up. And I haven't gotten it yet from Chris Paul, LeBron James, and those guys, but I think it will be coming because I'm hoping that they will change the name so that people will know when they come into the league, you're coming in under a ruling.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's it.
Yep.
Yeah.
Did among the current players, who has demonstrated the most interest in your story?
I would think, and he knows the story, but sometimes he don't give it up, is Kevin Durant, because we are Sonics, you know what I mean?
Sure.
So, yeah. And I remember when they was retiring my jersey before they left to go to Oklahoma. And Kevin Durant walked up to me and said, and we had a lot of players standing around because, you know, the jersey retirement. I went into the locker room. We were talking. He said, "This is the Godfather of all of this stuff." And he was a bad MF. And, you know, he went on and on. But when he see me, he seemed like he's like, you know, a little shy or something.
Yeah.
I don't know. And so I appreciate him.
Yeah.
And LeBron James is like, his people reached out to me to do Shut Up and Dribble, you know, and so I think that it's coming.
Yeah.
But, you know, the players, they're just learning about this. They
sure.
Didn't know.
Yep. What player reminds you of yourself as you watch them play? The guy that you look at and say, that's the current Spencer Haywood.
Yeah, now let's go back in a little history so I can tell these people so they can relate to it.
Yeah.
Okay. I was 19 at the Olympics. I set a record in the most points, the most rebounds, still on the record in the highest field goal percentage. And I held a record until Durant broke it in scoring recently. Also, before that, I was averaging 30 and 20 for a season.
30 points, then, 20 rebounds.
Yeah, in the playoffs with Denver, I went up to 36 and 21 for the first 12 games and the first time Denver ever went to a playoff.
Hmm.
So, and in college, I was the outstanding college player of the year behind Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. And I was averaging 33 and 22.
At little old Detroit Mercy.
Yeah, and at that time it was just University of Detroit.
Right.
Played everybody. It was independent conference, and so in high school, I was 26 and 26.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So when I see LeBron play, and if I hadn't, you know, like went through all of this stuff, I thought that would be my kind of guy because I was big and, you know, I had some juice on me because of the picking cotton back.
Sure.
And I kind of played a kind of a outside inside game, but I played a kind of a bully game too. So I looked at him and I said, well, you know, if I had stayed clean and sober and everything else and not fall in love when I went to New York.
Yeah.
I mean, that could have been me.
Yeah.
So look at him and say, hey,
so you've mentioned the recovery a number of times, and I'm guessing that that you weren't doing cocaine in Silver City, Mississippi.
No.
What was the first time? Because if I understand your story correctly, you know, you've recovered from everything. You're sober. You're clean and sober.
Right.
But that cocaine was the thing that, like, accelerated things or really took you down, right?
Took me down.
Where were you first introduced to it? What was the situation?
I was introduced to it in the fashion industry and everything in New York, but I was not a user in that sense.
Okay.
I tapped and I just moved on.
Right.
But when I got to LA and I was just brought in with the Lakers, the grand opportunity. We had Magic Johnson in his rookie year, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Jamal Wilkes, Norm Nixon, Michael Cooper, and we had a squad. Yet I go over to this, you know, people that I've been seeing on television. I'm sitting at this party at this mansion in Beverly Hills, and everybody is like running in and out of this room, and I'm trying to figure out, I know this guy. Oh my God, he's a movie star. I know these people. And so I'm like just excited. And then I wander into this room, and it's a beautiful room, you know, and they are like smoking, you know, they're smoking and they're smoking.
So they're freebasing.
Freebasing.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking, yeah. And they says, hey, you know what? If you do this, You don't have no drip in your nose. You don't have nothing. It's like organic in a way, because you wash all of the impurities out and you're just smoking the pure shit. I mean, I know it was a lie. I'm tripping. And I'm like, yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. So I go in here and I hit the shit.
Yeah.
And I'm smoking. And I'm thinking, wow, what kind of madness is this? And I didn't just hit it. I stayed there until like 4 a.m. Huh. I couldn't put it down.
Huh.
And that was my journey.
Yeah.
Because I came in there doing, let me give you an example of how I felt. I came in there doing, from New Orleans, I was doing 25 points, I think, and 12 rebounds.
Playing with the great Pistol Pete Maravich, correct?
Yeah. Pistol Pete, Gail Goodrich, Elgin Baylor was my coach. I'm in L.A. with Magic Johnson. All you had to do is do this, and he hit you with the ball. Oh, you know, like, but.
You better have your hands up, because he might throw it and
put it right
hit you in the head.
Oh, yeah. Okay, I'll just take the layup. So I watched my game go down, all the way down to like 7-5.
Yeah.
I have never averaged 7-5 since I was in elementary school.
Yeah.
Or even before then.
Yeah.
And I was like 15 pounds lighter, and I was a shell of myself.
Hmm.
And at the end of the season, you know, I was at a practice, and I had been up all night. I'm sitting in a practice. We're in the championship, like right now. This is the game.
Yeah.
Game 5. I fall asleep in practice.
Hmm.
Because I had quaaludes trying to keep my heart from jumping out of my chest. So I fell asleep. And the team says, well, you know, you got to take a break. And we had two games to go. And so I did. And after the season, the players on the team was like, if he don't get help right some kind of way, he's going to die.
Hmm.
And so Dr. Buss, Jerry West, Pat Riley, and Paul Westhead said, well, you know, let's send him to Italy. And I was like, I don't want to go to no Italy. I'm well. Look at me.
Yeah,
right. You know. And so, because I wanted to go to Dallas in the new expansion team.
Yeah.
So they send me over to Italy, and I get off the plane, Alitalia. I jump into Venice, and I'm looking around like, where's the city? It's out there in the ocean. So I get on this thing, and I go over there, and I'm so mad and so angry and like just hostile. And then the Italians were like so grateful to have me there, because they knew from the Olympics.
Sure.
They knew with Iman, it was like just a big celebration. So they just started loving me up like they did in Seattle.
Huh.
And loved all of the anger out of me. I got clean and straight, and I played great basketball over there. And so it was that journey.
Yeah.
And then I had a couple of slip-ups in between there after that, you know.
Yeah.
But then I started really practicing, you know, going to meetings, 12-step meetings, and I went to a recovery center out in your area. I think you're in the San Francisco area.
Yep.
Then I started making that journey all the way through. Like, how did I end up here? I ended up going to Egypt, going throughout Africa. Yeah, trying to figure out, how did I end up doing this? And then speaking with my psychologist and my psychiatrist, we started talking about how many people in your family have this disease? And I'm like, they didn't have a disease, but they died of alcoholism.
Right.
I'm talking about.
Right.
You know.
Right. So, they drank themselves to death, but nobody's ever had the disease. Yeah.
Right. You know.
Yeah.
So that's when I really started to take it serious.
Wow.
And Detroit helped me in my whole recovery, because I got that recovery community in Detroit.
Yeah.
That supported me, and I married a wonderful wife that I've been married to for 30 years. I have 4 daughters that have graduated college. I have 2 doctors in my family. I have 1 that's a psychologist. My 29-year-old psychologist.
Huh.
And then I have a professor at Lincoln University, Courtney, and Shakira is a doctor. Isis worked at Bleacher Report, and also she was over at Slam Magazine for years. Okay. And Zuleika from Iman, that marriage, she don't like me to say anything. She's an executive at the Koch brothers.
Is she really?
Yeah, because her husband, they live in Kansas, and they have raising their daughter. So, and I keep telling them, man, they do good things too.
Come on. So yeah. as we record this, you're wearing a Lakers shirt. Yeah. It took you a while because they didn't give you a championship ring initially, and they were given a lot of. I mean, you were really ostracized as a result of what happened at that time. Clearly, if you're wearing the Lakers jersey, you've come to terms with that and you reconciled. Yep. How did you end up reconciling? And because my first thing was, you know, the as we record this, the finals are going on, and I'm thinking, okay, well he's got to be, after reading the book, he's got to be rooting for the Heat. He's not rooting for the Lakers. And I see you wearing the purple and gold. So now I wonder, like, where's your head at as far as the franchise?
With the Lakers, you know, once you in the purple and gold, you know, that's your brand. And Jenny Buss has spoke with me and opened up a lot of good avenues. Hmm. Kareem Abdul-Jabbar brought me back and did the ring ceremony. And Magic Johnson has been, you know, with me now. His brother used to work for my foundation in Detroit. And Larry and I communicate a lot, so I'm there with them. Jim Jones and I speak a lot. Norm Nixon and I hang out and talk a lot about my crazy days. Michael Cooper and Jamal Wilkes is always around. They just beat me down so bad. We would have had 10 championships. What the hell happened to you? News to me on my head and stuff. And I'm like, So it's just, you know, when you let go and let God take over and let thy will be done and not your own, you seem to, like, let a lot out and let a lot of good. You know, you open your arms for the joy. And a lot go out, but so much more come in.
Yeah.
And then when the commissioner, you know, started working with me, helping me to get this book and get the contract, he and Charlie Rosenzweig from the NBA office, Adam Silver, is taking pictures with the book nowadays. Like, hey, this is our guy. So it's just a blitz.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't explain it. And then, you know, my favorite basketball player is playing on that team, LeBron. So, and, you know, I'm always getting a little controversial because I don't know who is the GOAT. And everybody keep asking me, who is the GOAT, man? You should know you played against everybody. You know this. And I said, well, yeah, you know, the big guy is the GOAT, but you can't market him.
Right. Right.
So it's got to be between Jordan and LeBron. And, you know, he's playing right now. I mean, Michael, can I tell you a quick Michael Jordan?
Sure, absolutely.
Michael called me up, and we're in New York. We're just, you know, hanging out.
By the way, just as a preface, Spencer Haywood was Michael Jordan with Nike before Michael Jordan. First Nike ad ever was with Spencer Haywood. Not Michael Jordan. Okay, continue with your Michael Jordan story. I wanted to make sure people understood the preface.
And that's what the story is about. Okay. So, this guy called me and says, Michael said he wants you to meet him down here in Lower Manhattan at the restaurant. They're going to talk about, you know, how important you were to him and everything. And how
When was this? Huh? When did this happen? When did you?
This was like 2 years ago, 3 years
ago. Oh, really? Okay. Okay.
So I'm going, let me go down and see what Mike is talking about. Because Mike has came to my room during the Legends events, and he came up and hung out with me and talked about stuff. I mean, we're just talking, not about basketball, but just life and stuff like that. So I get to the restaurant, and, you know, you got all these executives, because he was doing the negotiation with the players union at the time. So they got all the NBA executives in there. So I'm like, oh, man. So here's Mike, and he's like, let me tell you, who would have been richer than me?
Oh.
Mike, don't go here. He's like, no, this guy had a Nike contract before I did. He had the money bag. But he decided to trust his agent. And, you know, what happened was that they came in and said, well, the agent was like, I can't get my money out of this deal because you have ownership.
Because they were giving you stock.
They was giving me stock.
Yeah.
I don't get that money. So they had my power of attorney. They turned my stock back in and took the cash.
Pennies on the dollar.
Yeah, so Michael was eating me up.
So
that
that's why he wanted to meet with you 2-3 years ago?
He was talking to all of them about what I did for him and how he got to be this billionaire, zillionaire.
Yeah.
And yet he had to kind of, you know, Mike is always
going. Oh, yeah, yeah. He's always got the dagger. He's always got the needle.
A little taste. That's his love way.
Yeah,
that's his way of like loving.
That's his love language.
That's his love language. So I accepted it and I went home and I was like, damn, I should have.
All right, so
That was cool.
That's a good deal. So, and you are in the Nike Club. What does the Nike Club get you?
I get all of the shoes I want right
okay.
now.
Okay, so you get all the gear you want.
Yeah, well, I get everything I want and Phil Knight and I go back because not only then, but in 76, I think it was, we had a big event in Reno, outside of Reno and Lake Tahoe. And we had a problem getting, you know, women to be introduced to the brand. So he was like, well, you know, we need somebody to help us with this, you know? And so I was like, well, she's got a shoot. She's got a Calvin Klein shoe. And so I'm like, Iman, you gotta like go with me to this event. And she was like, I got my shoe. And so we called Calvin and he was like, damn, you're messing up the shoe. And so we fly up there and we hang out with him and all of the other Nike members. And so, and that's when all of the wives and everybody else said, well, if she's here, I'm coming too. And so all of the women came. And so that's the women brand, so to speak. So Phil has much love for me. He shows much respect. And I spend a lot of time now with Lynn Merritt.
Okay.
He's the head of basketball operations.
Yep.
We're doing a program for prostate cancer, the Prostate Cancer Foundation of America. We're looking to do something really big. And it's going to be released with the NBA soon.
Good.
And
okay.
Special thing because I'm a survivor of cancer as well.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. Survivor in many, many ways. Yeah. So before I want to wrap up on this, what is the likelihood that it will be known as the Spencer Haywood rule? Because obviously Adam Silver knows about the book. He knows about your situation. You've been re-embraced by the league.
Yes.
Is this something that you anticipate that is going to happen? And if so, when?
I don't know when, but I know it's going to happen. It is also incumbent upon the players, the union, the players union. Chris Paul is the head of the union, the executive board, Andre Iguodala, Steph Curry, Jaylen Brown. All of these players are under this ruling, so yeah. It's incumbent upon them to do it. And Michelle Roberts, she said we were going to do it sometime.
Yeah.
And so between the two of them, it will come. You know, and this is happening right now in front of me. It's like real-time stuff going on.
Good
and
deal.
So everybody that learned about this is saying, oh, of course it's the Spencer Haywood rule. And, you know, we talk about the NBA. But the NFL is using the same rule as well.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Good. Well, one sport at a time.
Well, one sport. I'm sticking with my NBA.
There you go. All right. Spencer, it's
go
been
Lions.
Thank you so much for the time. I really enjoyed the book and being reminded. I knew pieces of your story, but didn't know all of it. And congratulations on your recovery and your sobriety. And it's so good to hear you have come full circle. And I almost get a sense that while there might have been a bitterness at one point about what you experienced, there is an acceptance and a gratitude that
you got it. What you talking about, boy? You talking that recovery talk? An acceptance and gratitude.
Yeah,
such a beautiful thing.
Yeah. So, thank you for joining me, and I look forward to the announcement of the Spencer Haywood rule being part of the next collective bargaining agreement. But thank you for joining me.
Thank you. Much love.
That does it for this episode of Bucher and Friends. Please rate and review the show on iTunes or wherever you get your podcast. And in our next episode, we'll discuss the poor ratings for the NBA Finals, as well as what would have to happen for LeBron James to move into the top five all-time Lakers. Could he do it? And what would he have to do it? And who would be the one who would fall out? We'll also talk about the league's interest or intention now in starting the next season on Christmas Day and the possibility of that actually happening. All that in the next podcast. In the meantime, as always, thanks for listening.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.